Okay, are there any questions? No? You are in great danger. I'm waiting.
Can we ask a question about the phantom particles or not?
No, not yet.
Not yet.
Well, let's see, what's the question? What is a phantom particle? Is that a question?
That's the question.
Okay, no. That's not a real question, but I will answer it in a computer talk, not today. Any other question? Yes.
So there's something very mysterious about these weak values, that they seem to obey some interior logic, like some particular logic, like this.
Well, what? Say it again?
There's something strange about these, or mysterious about these weak values. They obey some particular logic. Is it possible that somehow they're just an artifact of linearity, that they're not physically meaningful?
It's a very interesting question, because obviously nature is consistent. So if we can calculate by using weak values predictions about what happened in experiment, then obviously all the statements about weak values must be consistent. Although at first they look very non-logical to us. Now, it doesn't look logical to speak about imaginary values for physical properties. It doesn't look logical to say that there is a negative probability. All kinds of things like this at first don't look logical. But when we learn to see how to use them and how they appear in nature, we simply have to develop a new intuition. It doesn't violate fundamental logic that says that I can't say at the same time that something is right and something is wrong. That wouldn't happen there. But other things that seems to be logical for us, like for example, that if we have three particles and only two boxes, I can never have a situation where no two of them will be in the same box. It turns out that quantum mechanics teaches us, as I will show today in fact, that that's not the case. What does it mean then? Does it mean that something is illogical here, or simply that our intuition leads us astray and we have to develop a new intuition? So you're right in the sense that weak values and weak measurement it's going to teach us new kinds of intuition, but not that it will be fundamentally against basic logic, that it will be something that completely.
There is an interesting kind of logic, like you have only one particle, you have one here, you have one here, therefore in some sense you have to have negative properties. If you have only one particle, and you have one here, and you have one here, then you deduce you have to have some sort of negative properties associated with the third box.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, this is what happens.
Right. Yeah.
And it could be that this is just a consequence of some sort of linearity theory. Is linear kind of has no choice, but it's a sort of mathematical artifact.
Yeah,
then a real physical. I'm not sure that means. I'm just
right. That anything that we deduce from weak values must be linear in the sense that only the weak values have only properties. The only property is that the weak value of a sum must be equal to the sum of weak values, but the weak value of a product is not equal to the product of the weak values, and that is connected very closely with the problem of contextuality in quantum mechanics. So there are many interesting things that can be say learned from weak values, and we are slowly going to learn them during those discussions. Any other questions? Yes.
So about your watch pot always boils analogy from yesterday.
Yeah.
So you start with a system that has some Hamiltonian, and you have a unitary evolution. And you, basically what you've said is you could replace this Hamiltonian evolution with this continuous sequence of measurements. Is that kind of what you're getting at? That we will ultimately be able to replace any kind of Hamiltonian evolution as some sequence of...
Yeah, it turns out that if you, a system is described by Hamiltonian, and by itself it would like to follow some orbit in Hilbert space, we come and make very, very dense measurement, and the system will follow completely different orbit than the one it would have followed by this Hamiltonian. Turns out that then the contribution of the Hamiltonian is only on the phase of that orbit, and that's exactly what's happening in the Feynman formalism. Feynman formalism tells you you can take the particle, move it in any orbit as you like from the initial point to the final point, and the only way that quantum dynamics shows itself is in the phase that is associated with this. And so the original Hamiltonian plays a role only of contributing a phase to that particular orbit, but not telling you how it moves, because we force it to move, by our strong belief, we force it to move in a completely different orbit. Yes, another question? Yeah.
So you started out 6 lectures ago by telling us about deterministic observables.
Yeah.
Now, a weak measurement when you have finite number of systems is almost a deterministic observable, but not a deterministic observable.
That's right.
So does this mean they have a different status?
Yeah, right. That's a very important question. If we look at a large number of particles that are all described by the same state, say it's a product, say spin half particle, product of all the particles are in the state sigma is equal to plus 1. And we ask now for this ensemble of large collection, what will be a true deterministic operator and what will be the type of operator that we discussed, which is the sum of the sigma x. A true deterministic operator has the property that if we measure it, if the system is not in an eigenstate, it becomes an eigenstate. That is not true for the type of thing that we have discussed, because if we look at the sum of sigma xn divided by n, and ask what will happen if we apply it to this, indeed we will get the answer 1, right? But suppose the system that we started with was a system of a product of sigma z equals to plus 1. That answer will give us 0, and if we don't produce an eigenstate of this, which is 1 or minus 1. So that means that there is a difference between the type of operators that we discussed, that if this ensemble is there, we will see it. But if it's not there, we don't see it. Well, if we discuss the true deterministic operator, which will be for this ensemble, it will be the product of sigma z, sigma xn, the product of that thing will be a true deterministic operator, but we can never realize that in real experiment, because that kind of product will be something that involves an interaction, an n-body interaction, which we can't realize in nature. So what is beautiful about nature is that if we have an ensemble, we can actually make a measurement of it that finds that it's there without disturbing the system. While a deterministic measurement, if it's not there, disturbs the system because it produces it. So there is a fundamental difference between, we are talking now about measurements that don't disturb the systems. So those measurements are not, in general, not true deterministic experiment, because deterministic experiment or experiment of measuring of production operators produce a system even if it wasn't there, right? So deterministic experiments are very limited that we have to measure only those that are really there. But those kinds of experiments we can do on any system and we'll get an answer if it so happens that the system is in the same state, all of them. Okay, any other question? All right, I want to start with a discussion that will really show the difference between the Heisenberg and Schrödinger picture or Schrödinger approach in the following way. As you know, in classical mechanics, before that was done, for example, in the 19th century, 18th century, 19th century, people discussed the classical mechanics with using arbitrary Hamiltonian. They look at Hamiltonian equation of motion for writing any Hamiltonians which are function of x and p, and there were canonical transformations that could transform x to p and p to x, and there was no restrictions to Hamiltonian of the form of p squared plus v of x. The restriction to this Hamiltonian are necessary only if we discuss a space and time that is not the Newtonian space and time, Newtonian Galilei, which has absolute time, but the time that is described by Lorentz, which means that we have to be able to transform time from one observer to another. So if we look, for example, at Hamiltonian, which is equal to cosine PL over H bar. Suppose we had an Hamiltonian like this. This Hamiltonian is consistent if we have a Galilean, if a Newtonian space-time, it's not consistent if we have a Lorentzian space-time. That's very important. Let's just see why this is the case. This Hamiltonian tells us that if we have a star, suppose I write in Hamiltonian g of t times cosine pl over h bar, where g is different from zero starting at a given time t. So before that time, if we look at the particle, we see the particle is stressed. This is the position x as a function of time. The particle is stressed until we switch this Hamiltonian. When we switch this Hamiltonian, the particle jumps from this point to a distance L away, either here or here, right? Because cosine PL over H bar is a translation operator. So we will have a picture where we start the particle here, and suddenly it jumps from here to here. Right, say, for example, this is consistent if we have absolute time, like the time, the true time of classical physics before relativity. No, I take g to be something that's zero up to some point, and from then on it starts to be constant. So, it's a step function. So up to dimension was zero up to a given time, and then I don't even have to start it immediately. But then I switch on the term.
Translation will only be
what?
Just appear slowly.
Both.
The
particle.
It doesn't jump. It only has a small amplitude.
Yeah, I know. Okay, it has a probability one here, and afterward
it starts to grow.
If I really make it very large, then it jumps. If it's small, then it has a small probability to be there, right?
Okay.
Yeah, so let's switch it very strongly. So then it will, after a very short time, I will find it with large probability here. And this is inconsistent if I have a Lorentzian time, because if I go to a frame of reference where this is the equal time, then in this frame of reference, I see that there is no particle here because that disappeared. There is no particle here because it wasn't there yet. So in this time, there was no particle at all.
From the left.
Hmm?
It's a little bit from the left.
What do you mean?
You still have a point on the left.
Yeah, because it's a real Hamiltonian.
Where? Here?
No.
The also P at minus L.
This moves both to the left and to the right.
Oh, no. Suppose I just move. It's a situation where I had this with the IPL over H bar. Okay, so, all right. It says the probability one has to be here, but it's the probability one has to be here. So the probability now is only one half to see a particle, right? On the other hand, if I go this way, I see many particles, because I see that particle is fully here. I see another half a particle there, right? And therefore, there will be one half particle here and half a particle here, right? Together. So anyhow, it's not consistent with conservation, though.
Hmm?
Huh?
You
You're saying the answer is frame dependent.
Yeah, right. So probably I couldn't compare probabilities of particles if I had a cosine pi over h bar and Lorentzian time. On the other hand, if I had cosine pi over h bar in Galilean time or Newton Galilean time, then it's consistent with conservation law. So I thought to myself, what would have happened historically if quantum mechanics was discovered before relativity, say, in the 19th century? Suppose there was an experimentalist like Rutherford that did an experiment scattering particles from matter, and he found indeed that the atoms are made of the way that Rutherford, and he was realized that the world is not consistent. Then somebody like Bohr would have come and invented the quantum model for the atom, and this could have been discovered before relativity. Then people would try to discuss quantum mechanics in the absolute time frame, because it was pre-relativity. And in fact, one can say something even more strongly. Quantum mechanics that we call now non-relativistic quantum mechanics is not fully consistent with the idea that we have a definite number of particles. Because we know that if we try, for example, to come and localize the electron more than its quantum wavelength, we create pairs, right? So what we call non-relativistic quantum mechanics is not truly non-relativistic. We can imagine what would it have been, what could quantum mechanics be if we had truly absolute time. This would be then a fully consistent theory in which we are allowed to discuss arbitrary Hamiltonians as a function of x and p. So I think it's very interesting to try and see how we would approach this kind of quantum mechanics. So let me show you some very interesting things that we discuss in this kind of physics.
Just to be clear, you're saying if we did not have relativity,
yeah,
but we had absolute time, how would we approach quantum?
That's right.
So
we have now, we are in the 19th century, we discovered that we have to write an Hamiltonian which is commutator instead of Poisson bracket, but we use this kind of physics with in the frame of reference of absolute time and Galilean invariance.
Huh? We have to be before Maxwell. We were Hamilton.
No, even Maxwell, people discussed Maxwell equations before they knew about relativity, and then you could explain, you know, even the Lorentz transformation saying there is an ether and the ether affects the. Yeah, there is. Sorry?
Maxwell's equations are not consistent with Galilean.
They are consistent. What do you say?
There's an ether
that consists. Yeah, it's more argument to say, as Lorentz believed, that you still have absolute space time. And he said the reason why when things move, the reason why the velocity of light is the same for the observer is that when the observer is moving relative to ether, his clocks and rulers are behaving this way. You say it's ugly, but it's consistent. Okay? So it's a question, it's a consistent physics even with Maxwell's equation. But let's not worry about that. Let's assume that we just have particles that interact instantaneously with each other, as Newton believes, and we have absolute space-time, and we discuss this kind of quantum mechanics.
So you want to change the history?
Sorry?
So you want to change the history in a way?
No,
so you are discovering quantum mechanics prior to
I don't want to change the history. I'm saying we have an interesting toy model, and that is what would quantum mechanics look if we discuss it in absolute time, namely in the Galilean space-time. It's interesting because, first of all, it's a consistent theory. Second, it preserves the number of particles, not like our, what we call quantum, non-relativistic quantum mechanics, which is not a purely concept. This is a very beautiful, consistent theory. And let's see what we can say about it. So in this theory, I'm allowed to indeed write a Hamiltonian, which is cosine PL over H bar times some G. Let me show you some very beautiful things that we can do with this Hamiltonian. And by the way, this will be connected with the question that Lucille asked me few lectures ago, how will we do quantum mechanics on discrete lattice rather than continuum, because this is useful for computational things. This automatically will do that. Because in this kind of Hamiltonian, it's a one dimension, let's have the line. If I start with a particle here, it will only be found later at points, at discrete points, which are distance n times L away. So I will have now a complete theory in which I can discuss the whole quantum mechanics just on a discrete set of points, okay? Now suppose, let me show you what's very entertaining thing. Suppose the Hamiltonian is G times cosine px over L h bar plus some potential V of x. So let me do the following. Suppose this is a distance L, and I put a potential V of x, which is zero here, and very, very large here, and very large here. And that's what will happen in this case. Can I find any eigenstate of energy which is small compared to V? What do you guess? Suppose if I look at a particle here, then the Hamiltonian immediately take it into the region. This is the region where the huge potential, the only place the particle allows to live is here, right? Mm-hmm. So if I start the particle here, the Hamiltonian will immediately take it into the region of very large V. What do you see, what do you think will happen? Well, could I find an eigenstate of energy or not? Okay, I will start this for this. I will start this exercise and then show you what happens when I have more interesting situation. So suppose I assume that the wave function here, the amplitude here is 1. If the amplitude here is 1, then when the Hamiltonian acts on it, it will take it from this point to a distance L away here and to a distance L away here. What amplitude should I put here and here? So if from 1 here, I jump here to an amplitude G, right? Because this takes to this G. So I have from here G.
Is the distance from the cross to the border equal L? Is the distance from that point was 1 to the border equal L? Which is the distance L?
B is the split function.
Let me be very careful. I am saying the size of my box is A. That means that here I have very large potential of V, here I have very large potential of V, and here the potential is zero. Okay? I want to find a solution to my Hamiltonian by assuming that I know that the value of the function here, I can always choose by normalization the value of the function at a given point to be what I want, so I put here the value 1. And see if it's consistent to continue from that. So I'm saying when I apply this Hamiltonian to this point, it will suppose the point is the center, it will take it, the act of that, the V here is zero, so the V doesn't do anything to it. The G takes it from here to here by distance L, and I see that contribution here, which is equal to 1. How can this contribution be canceled? If I have here an amplitude which is minus G over V, Then when I'm multiplied by the potential here, I get the value minus g, right? Suppose the amplitude here is minus g over v. Then what does this equation tell me? That I see here two contributions. One, the one coming from here to here, which will be g. And the other, the potential multiply this, which will be minus g. So they will cancel each other. And I will get a consistent possibility if the energy is very close to zero. So in fact, I claim that I can solve this problem with an energy, and I leave it to you now as an exercise, with an energy which is equal to g over the energy will be equal to g squared over v. And the question is whether minus or plus.
V evaluated
in
L?
What?
What x is v evaluated at?
Say it again.
What is the argument?
V is 0 and v is 0.
Oh, b is a step function?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a square root.
Okay.
Okay, let us make a trial function and see if I'm right. So again, I have here a re-entry A where v is equal to 0. Here, from then on, v is large and equal to v here. And on this side, v is large and equal to v here. Okay? I want to see if I can find now a solution, an eigenstate with the energy being equal to something divided by v, so that it will go to zero if v is infinite. In fact, let me first show to you that it's consistent if v is infinite to have here just a single point with an eigenstate of energy that is equal to zero. Let us see that. Okay? And there will be one solution like this. In fact, infinite is a generic number if I'm allowed to put it at any point, but let me assume that I only look at this grid. I'm claiming that if v is equal to infinite here, and v is equal to infinite here, then I have a consistent solution, which is the wave function being here, and the energy is zero. Let's see if it's consistent. So if the wave function is here, I want to write that h psi is equal to zero, right? So if I have one here, I look what h psi does to it. V is zero, g takes it away, so therefore nothing is left here, right? Provided I don't have any contribution coming from here or from here. So if I assume that it's one here and zero here and zero here, it's consistent. Why? When I look at the one at the point here, I say, what can contribute to this point? The product of v times that point is zero. The product of e times that point is zero if I assume that e is zero. So I get here a consistent zero, provided nothing comes from here or from here. If I assume that it's zero here and zero here, then this nothing will come from here, nothing will come from here, so this will be consistent. Now, if I look what happens at this point, this is consistent here to have zero, okay? So this thing comes from here and brings one here, or in fact, brings d here, right? But if there was also another contribution here, which was minus d over v, that contribution will cancel that one, right? And at the limit, when v goes to infinite, I need zero contribution here to cancel that thing. So this is a consistent solution for this Hamiltonian with exactly eigenvalue zero and a contribution here. Now, the game starts to be much, much more interesting if I have the following situation. Suppose I now have a possibility where v is very large here and it's infinite here and infinite here, and these are both of scale L here. This will be like a double. So this will be like a situation in normal quantum mechanics where I have a particle here or a particle here with a barrier in the middle. So it turns out that when I solve this problem with V here very, very large, I think that I would like to do it more carefully the following way. You will see that after you learn to think about it a little bit more, it becomes beautiful mathematics. So I just show you a number of examples. I take L here where the potential is equal to zero. I take L here where the potential is very large, but finite, very large. This will be like my barrier for tunneling. Then I take here L where the potential is zero. And then afterwards, the potential is infinite here, and the potential is infinite here. So I try to solve this problem, and I leave it to you now as a home exercise. I will find indeed that there are two solutions, one that is one here and one here, and the other is one here and minus one here. And these two solutions will be just the usual thing that happens in when we have double potential waves. So I suggest that for a number of reasons, it's very interesting to consider this kind of Hamiltonian instead of the usual one. Instead of the p squared over 2m plus b of x, to consider Hamiltonian cosine p over h bar, it will give us quantum mechanics on the lattice instead of continuous, and it will mimic all of the usual things that we do, but it will have the following advantage. Nobody in this kind of dynamics will ever dream of thinking about Schrödinger waves. The Heisenberg equations of motion are beautiful here. Everything you will see that the Heisenberg equations of motion are that's very natural here. But if you try to look at Schrödinger equation of motion, Schrödinger equation of motion says, look at the amplitude in position representation. This amplitude in position representation jumps. Nobody would think about it as a wave. There is no continuity, no conservation of probabilities. Schrödinger, nobody will dream ever to think about Schrödinger equation. The only Heisenberg equation will play a role. And therefore I'm saying that if we look really, on the only truly consistent quantum mechanics, non-relativistic quantum mechanics that we know about, the one in absolute time, and not the one in the Lorentzian time, then you can forget about Schrödinger waves. There is no waves at all. The only things that exist are really Heisenberg equation of motion, and you describe the system really with the deterministic operators and the Heisenberg equation of motion, the way that I discuss it. This, I think, is going to be a very valuable lesson, and I suggest that you try to solve a number of simple models like this. It's beautiful mathematics. It's really very nice to try and solve simple examples with this kind of Hamiltonian. Any questions about that? Yes?
It's the case that the potential, middle potential,
sorry?
Is the middle middle of the potential. It now is the width of that L. The,
here?
Here? Yeah. In the case, does the change in the width of that the potential?
If that potential is infinite, then again you have only two eigenstates of energies which are zero. But if the potential is finite here, you will see that you have two different eigenstates of energy, one for this plus that and the other for this minus that, and the difference between them is of the order of 1 over V with the potential in the middle, the barrier.
Yeah, that's the barrier is the width of that width.
No,
the width is asking how wide
no,
the potential is.
I put here the distance of the same L, but I could of course make it much narrower as long as I will choose a point that exactly jump into that potential. If I take a much narrower potential, I could start with a point here that will never experience that potential.
Right.
Because it will skip over it, we just know about it. So if I want to make sure that I am free to choose any grid here, then I should then the range of this place where the potential is here must be also of the order of L. that's the reason why I choose this beer. Otherwise, I can, of course, choose only, I can choose only this grid of points, and then it's enough that the potential will be just here. That will be enough, okay? It can be very narrow. Provided I choose a particular grid. What?
Yeah, that's the case. The two, for example, is the middle between the two L. Twice do that, and now it's a kind of same quantum situation. That's the case.
Let's talk about it. I'm not sure I understand you. Let's talk about it later.
All right. Okay. Yeah.
Now, I will have more to say about this later, and now I come back to our usual Hamiltonian and show you there the difference between the Heisenberg-Schrödinger approach and the advantage of the Heisenberg approach. So let's again think about the simplest example that we can think about, which is an example where I have two cavities and initially the barrier is infinite, so I have two degenerate states, this one and that one, or this plus this, or this minus this, or this alone, or this alone. These are two degenerate eigenstates of the energy in these cavities, the lowest energy, if the barrier in the middle is infinite. If I reduce the barrier to a finite barrier, then I know that the two degenerate states become non-degenerate, and there is the lowest energy state will be this plus this, and the higher state will be this minus this, with a difference of energy of delta E. And we are going to look at this, just at this very simple example, as a kind of theoretical laboratory test to compare how Heisenberg will approach this problem and how Schrödinger will approach this problem. So let's first look at this problem from the point of view of Schrödinger. So I know that I have two eigenstates of energy. One is left plus right, that oscillates in time as e to the minus I in c over h bar, and left minus right, whose time dependence is e to the plus I in c over h bar. 2e is the difference of the energies from the ground state to the first excited state. Now let's see what will happen if I start initially with psi at time zero is equal simply to the left one. I start initially at time zero, knowing that the particle is in this box, okay? I want to see now how it evolves in function of time. So I can write this as left plus right divided by 2 plus left minus right divided by 2. This is the initial state, right? So the state now as a function of time will be equal to left plus right over 2 into the minus I e c over h bar. Let me write e over h bar, let me define it to be omega. So we have here e to the minus I omega t plus left minus right over 2 e to the I omega t, right? So I see that if I add the terms for the left will be multiplied by cosine omega t, and the right will be multiplied by I sine omega t. So therefore I say that the solution in function of time will be left times cosine omega t plus I right times sine omega t. Now, notice here something interesting. That when omega t is equal to pi, that thing becomes just minus itself. So if I start with left, and after time omega t equals to pi, I get minus left. There is no difference between minus left and plus left because it's just a phase. That means I don't have to wait the whole 2 pi period. After 1 pi period, the system comes back to itself, multiplied by minus 1. That is a sign that is connected with the fact that the two-vector Hilbert space is really isomorphic to spin half. And spin half has the property that after 2 pi, it comes to minus itself, okay? So let me now look now at time t and look at four discrete points of time. This is time equal to zero. This is time corresponding to pi over four, that omega t is equal to pi over four. This is pi over two. This is 3 pi over 4, and pi, right? Okay? So if I start here with left, I see here at this time left plus I right. At this time, I see minus I right or plus I right. I have to check this, right? And then here I see left minus I right. It's orthogonal to this thing. I can write it minus. And minus. Then, minus doesn't minus matter because. Okay, I can multiply the whole thing by minus. It doesn't matter. It's a phase, right?
Yeah.
I know, right. And then finally, I see here. I left again, right?
Minus left.
Minus left. No. Minus left, sorry. Minus left, right. So now, I want to say the following. Suppose I start with my initial state with this state, at this time. So if I start at this time, I say that I start initially with a superposition of that plus I times that. Then I wait this period of time, and I see that the particle ends up completely here. And I notice that if I would start with this one alone, the particle will end up in both boxes. If I start with this one alone, the particle ends up with both boxes. But if I start with the linear combination of them, the particle doesn't appear in one of the boxes that it would have appeared there if I would have started with a local thing. So this is the famous interference situation. People say, I know that I must have contribution in both places in order to make sure that later I will have zeros only in one box. Because if I start with this one alone, or I start with this one alone, each one of these possibilities contributes something in both boxes. So this is the famous idea that from looking at interference, we can deduce in the Schrödinger picture that there must be amplitude here and there must be amplitude here in order to explain why later I don't see something in one of the boxes because of destructive interference. So this is, in a nutshell, the simplest example that we can have in order to see this kind of thing that I don't like at all, which says that we must talk about amplitudes to explain what happens later. And we don't know what it means to think about this amplitude at this time, because what does it mean that we have the particle both here and here? Part of it is here and part of it. There is no understanding what it means apart from understanding how it will appear later, but not what it means at the present to say that the particle is at the same time at both locations, okay? Now, I want to add one more thing to that picture. I want now to look at this problem with having both pre and post selection. Suppose my pre-selection is this state, and my post-selection is a state that corresponds at this time to just having left alone. I can do a situation where I have two vectors. The initial vector is the linear combination of this plus that, and the final vector, when I bring it back in time, is going to be this the vector left alone. Okay? You see that, I can do that.
Hmm? What is the final state?
The final state is depends what time I am choosing it. Suppose I choose the final state to be the final time to be just a full pi away from here. So in that final time, which is full pi away from here, I choose left. I go back in time up to here. I find that it's left here. So I always choose the final condition, just appear pi away, and there I put whatever I want to appear here. So therefore I assume, okay, so I assume therefore, if I draw this picture again, so here's time. I now choose in my initial time, I choose the straight left plus it. Plus I right. And then I go the four steps away. This is pi over four. And here I choose the state post selection, the state left. Okay? The pre selection will come here to a linear combination. But I choose now post selection, which is left. I go with this state back to this initial time, and I say now that in this initial time, I have in the Schrödinger picture a statement. One, that I know for sure that the particle is the left. And the other, that I know for sure that the particle is in both places. This is nonsense. Absolutely nonsense. How can I say at the same time these two contradictory statements? One, that I am sure that if I look, I would find the particle definitely there. And the other, with the same breath, I'm saying, no, I'm sure also the particle must be here and here because later it will appear only there. So I'm saying now two logically contradictory statements, right? Something is really wrong when I try to, in the Schrödinger picture, to describe what is going on here when I have pre and post selection. I have at the same time to say two things that don't make sense. In one sense, I'm sure that the particle is on the left box, and in the other hand, I'm sure that the particle is half in the left and half in the box. How can it be true? So let's see now how Heisenberg language described this same problem in a way that we have no statement that will make sense, which will give the same prediction, but in much nicer way. So let's now discuss the whole problem from Heisenberg's point of view. So in the case of Heisenberg, I have to look, instead of wave function, I have to look at operators. So Heisenberg will say, first of all, I have an Hamiltonian, which is 2e times sigma e. Let me first define what the three operators sigma is. I have an operator sigma z that has the property that if sigma z is equal to plus 1, this is what I called before the left state, and if sigma z is equal to minus 1, this is what I called before the right state, okay? And then, if I look at left plus right, this is divided by square root of 2. This is the state sigma x equal to plus 1. So I know, therefore, that the Hamiltonian gives me e times sigma x. The Hamiltonian gives me plus, I say minus e. If sigma x is equal to plus 1, I have this plus that. I know that it has the energy minus e. And if sigma x is equal to minus 1, this minus that, it has the energy plus e. So the difference between the energy is 2e, okay? So Heisenberg will say, I describe this problem by an Hamiltonian, which is minus e times sigma e. And then we have one third operator, which is sigma y. And I find the meaning of this operator by asking, what is the time derivative of the operator sigma z? The time derivative of the operator sigma z is the commutator of sigma z with sigma x divided by is bar, h is one here, by is, and that gives us indeed sigma y up to a sign. Right? The commutator of sigma z and sigma x is sigma y, I sigma y. So this means that sigma z is equal to sigma y. And times omega or times e, right? So then I can solve this problem.
This is just an operator statement,
what?
Not a cat statement.
Operator equation. You're right. The operator sigma z dose is equal to this, which is equal to sigma y times e. So I can solve the Heisenberg equation of motion by saying the following. Sigma x at time t is equal to sigma x at time 0 because it commutes with the Hamiltonian. And sigma x at time t is equal to sigma x at time 0 times cosine omega t, the way that I defined omega before, plus sigma y at time 0 times sine omega t.
Say
it again?
That should be.
On the left hand side, you should have sigma z of t.
Sigma z.
Sigma z. It's all sigma z. I'm not fully here today for some reason. Okay, that's sigma z, yeah. And then sigma y as a function of t is equal to minus sigma z at time 0 sine omega t plus sigma y at time 0 cosine omega t. I think that's correct, okay? So this is the Heisenberg equation of motion for all times. Now, look at the initial and final boundary conditions that we all before. Heisenberg will say the initial condition is, first of all, sigma y at time 0 is equal to 1, and at the same time, sigma z at time 0 is equal to 1. That tells me that initially, I know that initially, if I look at the box, I will find that the part is the left box, and at the same time, I know what is sigma y. Now, from the point of view of Heisenberg, there is no problem. We say we know in our two boxes, we know that the particle sits here initially. And while it is sitting here, it has also another property, which is a non-local property, sigma y. Why is it a non-local property? Because if I will put now a potential here, you know that the potential here changes the phase of the wave function. So it will change the state left plus I right, if I just put it in the right time, to the state left minus I right. So even though the particle is here, sigma y will change. Why does it happen? What Heisenberg will tell us. Heisenberg will tell us that if we add a potential here, which is 1 minus sigma z, 1 plus sigma z over 2 times some v, that means that this potential is different from 0, maybe 1 minus z, only on the right box. This is an operator different from 0 on the right box. So suppose I add here a potential for some time, v, and such a potential. What does it do to sigma y? C sigma y dot, the time derivative, is equal to the commutator of sigma y with the Hamiltonian. And this is, yeah. So it will first of all have the usual commutator, but then it has a correction from here. The correction from here doesn't matter for it. The one doesn't matter here. So therefore, it will know about the potential that I put here, even though the particle is on the left side. So Heisenberg tells me, look, if I have the part, I know the particle is here, I know the sigma z is equal to 1. I also know that the particle sits here with sigma y definite. That sigma y tells you what will happen to the particle later. Because remember, the solution of sigma z later is equal to sigma z at 0 times cosine omega t plus sigma y of 0 times sine omega t. So Heisenberg tells me, look, you know sigma z initially, and you know sigma y initially, right? So Heisenberg tells me that after the period pi over, after the right period, this will go to 1, then sigma y will turn into sigma z. So therefore, Heisenberg tells me, you know that the particle sits here. You know that it has another property, which is sigma y, that will later turn into sigma z. But it sits here. And it explains why, if I put the potential here, it will later, instead of turning here, will come to the other place. It's only because the equations of motion for sigma y are non-local. So I'm saying that we see here, in a very simple, basic, most basic example, everything that I was trying to talk about. One, I can speak about deterministic operators that tell me what's happening to the system. These deterministic operators have the property that they tell me what is happening now and also what will happen later if I'm only interested in the local information. I can come and observe only local things in our quantum mechanics, not in the quantum mechanics that would have happened in the 19th century, but in our quantum mechanics, we are only allowed to look at all local operators. We're only allowed to observe sigma z. That's the only thing that interferes. So we know that initially, sigma z is equal to 1 from the future boundary condition. We also know that there is sigma y sitting there, which we can't observe now, because we are not allowed to observe it, but it's there. And it has no local equations of motion. It's that thing that is sitting there that will turn later to something that we can see, which is the sigma z. We can change it while now, when we are not allowed to look at it, we can change it by having the non-local equations of motion. The Heisenberg non-local equation of motion. So that explains everything about the two-slit experiment. In a way that makes sense, not in a way to talk about things that we don't understand. Here is the usual two-slit dilemma, or two-slit paradox. We always looked at it up to now in the language of waves. So in the language of waves, we say, there is some mysterious wave that comes here, part of it is here, part of it is here, and then it comes here and interferes. And it's true for each particle that it has these two contributions. Then we ask, what does it mean that each particle has these two contributions? There is no way to see them, because if we try to look for the two contributions at this instance of time, we always say, finds all of it here, never part here and part there. So at this instance of time, there is no meaning to say, in physical way, in physics language, what it means to be here and here, because there is no observation that we can do that will say, show it. There is mathematics that we can use. So I remember I talked about the language. If we want to be a slave to the mathematics language, we say, okay, we understand the mathematics is there, and that will tell us what happens later. We are satisfied. But if we try to go beyond this, more deeply and ask, what is this mathematics saying us as far as physics is concerned? We don't know what it means. Then we say, then people say, okay, maybe we have to understand this only as probabilities. Then people say, if it's probabilities, then the particle really always goes through one of them. Then how on earth does the particle know if the other slit is open or not? That's where everybody then stops in saying it couldn't be just probabilities, because if it's just probabilities, we will never understand why the behavior of the particle is different when both slits are open or one slit is open. And what was missing in this discussion is the possibility that contrary to everything that we knew up to now, there is a new physics that has fully non-local equations of motion. In this new physics, we can think about the particles moving here, and at the same time, knowing whether this slit is open or not, because it has another property when it's here, which has non-local equations of motion. And I described all of this here. Now, at that instance of time, people may think that we run into inconsistency with causality, because we say, if the particle is moving here, and it has also on top of it the variable that we call now sigma y, the non-local modular momentum, which is the same thing, the trick here, and the equation of motion of this modular momentum depends now at that instance of time, whether this is open or not, then what will happen? I just close it now, and immediately that modular momentum will change, and I will be able to send information faster than light. So something must go wrong. What saves us here are the uncertainty principle, and the discussion of that will follow after intermission. Are there any questions so far? Yeah? Question? No? Questions? Okay. Yes?
Is there anybody who seriously thinks that if you close one slit, then immediately whatever passes through the other slit is immediately informed by that? Because what the formula shows that you have to wait for the two.
No. Wait. The formula shows that. Wait with this. This will be discussed later, okay? Yeah, it's an instantaneous. Okay. Any other? All right, let's have information. Okay, first I urge you to try and solve this problem with the Hamiltonian cosine PL over H bar plus V of X, where there is a distant L here, where there is a large but finite V. The potential here is zero, the potential here is zero, again for this is L, and here the potential is infinite, and here the potential is infinite. And find the ground state and the first excited state of this problem. You will find that it's very enlightening, and then you can play this game for yourself with maybe having more than two of them, having three of them. It's very, very entertaining mathematics. I like it very much. You will see that you will enjoy doing this problem. Okay, coming back to what I discussed last hour.
You want us to solve it in the Schrodinger picture?
No, in any picture that you like. Schrodinger or Eisenberg, let's solve it. Yeah. Now, then if you like to think of more interesting generalization, suppose I have the problem with just infinite potential here, but the Hamiltonian now, and this is distance L, the Hamiltonian is equal to cosine PL1 over H bar plus cosine PL2 over H bar. Where L1 and L2, the difference between them is small compared to L. So then we can have, from this, you can jump from here and come back to the next point here, if the distance between them. So something more interesting structured comes about this way. Once you start to think about it, you will see there are beautiful problems that you can think about in this language. Okay, coming back to the main point of my talk was the idea that we can solve, finally, we can solve the two-slit paradox in quantum mechanics by getting rid of the idea that we need a wave to explain interference, and instead we replace it by the idea that we always have only particles. These particles are always at some definite location, which in general we don't know where they are, but they are always in some definite location. And at the same time, while they are at this definite location, they have also other properties, and those properties have non-local equations of motion, and the non-local properties at a given time are those that dictate what will be the local properties later. I think that in order to understand better these non-local equations of motion, I will now devote this hour and also the next session to the most fundamental example of non-local interaction, which is the AB effect, the Aronoff-Bohm effect. So I'm going to discuss this now, show how from this effect we find that the modular variables are the best way to describe it, and see how the interaction between the source for the AB and the particle are due to exchange, non-local exchange of this modular variable, and see when this non-local exchange takes place. So this will give us an example, much more physical, concrete example, to understand this non-local phenomenon of quantum mechanics. So let me now review the AB effect and see how from this effect the modular variables come naturally and their non-local equations of motion appear as the best way to understand, the correct way to understand what's going on. So first of all, I want to tell you the story. How did I come to think about this effect to begin with? So I was a graduate student then, and I just learned about the beautiful Bloch theory about what happens when you have a periodic potential in position, the explanation of what happens in transistors and other things. You remember what it is. If I have an Hamiltonian, say in one dimension, p squared over 2m, plus a potential v of x, or v of x is equal to v of x plus n. And suppose this potential is very small, and I want to look what happens to it in first order. So when you do first order perturbation theory, you have to be very careful when you have two degenerate states, because the two degenerate states are connected strongly even if the potential is very small. So if we look at the free Hamiltonian, the energy is a function of the momentum, p. This looks like E is equal to p squared. It looks like that. The potential V of x, when it acts on x and state of momentum, makes it jump by momentum h over L. Right? If you have the first order transition operator, the transition amplitude is proportional to the potential, the initial state, and the final state. So this tells you this is final. If I have such a potential, the first order transition in perturbation theory is proportional to this element. If the initial state psi n, the amplitude rho to psi f is proportional to this, has to be divided by the energy difference up to a sign. So if this is very small, Usually that element is very small, but because it's divided by EF minus EI, if these two are the same, then this denominator is zero, and then we can't simply use the usual way. We have first to solve exactly the problem of these two levels, not by perturbation theory. Now, if you have a potential cosine x, cosine kx, and you put here e to the I k1x and e to the minus I k2x, these are the eigen energy solutions without the Hamiltonian. This integral, dx, is different from zero if the difference between k1 and k2 is equal to k, right? Because cosine kx is e to the I k plus e to the minus I k, so in order to get you something different from zero in the integral, this must be equal to the difference between these two. That means that if we find two momentum here and here, which can get connected by this periodic potential, then we are in trouble because we have here degeneracy. And then what happens when you solve this problem exactly, you see that there is a split, the sum and the difference get split in energy, and you develop here a range of energies which are missing. The two things have the same energy, and now the plus and the minus get separated, and you get the famous idea that you have gaps in energy, and that's actually the solution, and that explains lots of interesting properties of band structure, and the transistors and other examples are all properties of this thing. I don't want to go into all this in solid state. I just wanted to introduce to you that one notion here that interested me very much. So when I heard about this, when I read about this, I asked myself, why can't I find an example where I have a potential which is periodic in time, and I change position to time, and therefore I have to change energy to momentum, and maybe I will get gaps in momentum rather than energy. Okay? This was my thought. So I say, okay, I will have a particle and put, I have the Hamiltonian, I have the initial Hamiltonian, I add to it some potential V of t which is periodic. I solve this problem and I found very easily that what happens to psi when I add the potential, if psi goes to psi times e to the minus I, the integral of the potential, divided by h bar. And since the potential is only a function of time, that thing did nothing because it only changed the wave function by a phase. And when I change the wave function by a phase, nothing happened. So I was very unhappy about it. And I told myself, okay, there is nothing in this idea. And by the way, the digression. The reason why this doesn't work is because I don't have a situation where for the same momentum I have two different energies that could be connected this way. If I go to the Dirac equation, then I know that if I would there put a potential, periodic potential, I can go back and forth between positive energy solution, negative energy solution, and then something indeed interesting will happen. But I did not think about non-relativistic theory. I thought about non-relativistic quantum mechanics, and I remember at that time I decided there is nothing in this idea. And again, I went to sleep. I told you many times that when I wake up in the morning, something happened. I woke up in the morning, and I said, oh, maybe something interesting can happen if I do the following thing. Suppose I have a particle which is localized either here or here, and suppose I put a potential which is a function of time only here and not here. So then that potential will change that phase, It will not change the phase here, and then it will be something observable because I could see the effect by interference. So I started to play the following game. Bohm was my advisor. Before I came to Bohm with this idea, I wanted to make it a bit more concrete. So I say, suppose I have a Faraday cage and another Faraday cage. Faraday cage is, it's called Faraday cage, I guess, because Faraday discussed it the first time, that if you have an empty sphere, the sphere is conductor, and if you sit inside the sphere, anything that you do outside, by you change charges outside, will not penetrate inside because the potential inside can change only as a function of time. It can, because of the spherical symmetry of the conductor that makes it the potential the same on all the surface. So if a charge moves outside here, the potential is increased, but it increases the same way all over the sphere because it's a constant. Conductor must have constant potential, so the penetration inside will be only time dependent. Okay? So I have now a situation where I have two Faraday cages. One, for example, is always grounded, so the potential here is kept fixed to be equal to zero. And if I now let some charge go by here, then it will increase, if it's positive, it will increase the potential here. The potential here will still be zero. So this will be a way to introduce a time-dependent potential here with the potential here being set to zero, okay? Right? So suppose now that before I do that, I have little door here and here. I take one single electron and send it, prepare it in a linear superposition of being in this Faraday cage and in that Faraday cage. Say with probability 1/2. And then I close the door. So this was done when there was no charge outside, no potential at all. While my electron now sits in this superposition, I bring some external charge, make it move here, or vice versa, I can increase the potential by a battery. I make a situation where for a finite time there was a potential here and no potential here. So the particle wave that was here is multiplied by a phase which depends not only on the potential but the integral of the potential. So therefore, this will be changed by a phase factor that will remember how much potential was here even after this charge goes away. So for a while, I increase the potential on the left side, I keep the potential zero on the outside, and therefore the end result will be that this will be multiplied by some phase, and this will be the same phase as before. After the charge outside went away, I can now safely open the doors again, send the particles out, send the electron out, it doesn't experience any force, that all the forces disappeared, and nevertheless, even though it never experienced any force at all, because the force was only outside, there will be some effect now. If I look at the interference pattern, it depends on the relative phase, and that will change. So this will be the first example that we see of a situation when we have a particle that all its life was spent only in regions that were like vacuum. Nothing was in this region because potential is nothing. So there was a particle that moved all the time in a vacuum, and nevertheless it experienced something. So it experienced either potentials, which are not meaningless. I can't say the potential here is different and the potential here is zero. I can change the potential so that the potential will be minus V here and zero here. It's the same situation. The only thing that that has physical meaning is how much force was here. So to say that I saw here a local effect of potential is meaningless because potentials are not defined locally. So I prefer to say that this electron experienced non-locally the effect that there was an electric field elsewhere. So this is my first example, physical example now, where we can see that in quantum mechanics, there is something truly non-local in the dynamical equation of motion. Something in the dynamic properties of this electron was affected non-locally by the fact that there was a force here, okay? So you begin to see that here now I have a physical, really physical situation where I can talk about non-local equations of motion that disappear in the classical limit. Because in the classical limit, classical particles will never feel the effect of a force that is elsewhere. And we can understand that as a side remark, that if the thing that is affected non-locally is this operator, this observable, or cosine of it, which is the motion momentum, think what happens if I go with h to 0 and keep f fixed. Indeed, I will still have a non-local equation of motion, but for a variable that I could never observe. Because when h goes to 0, p modulo h over l, this is p modulo p0, if l is fixed and h goes to 0, then this p0 goes to 0. So instead of having something like this, I have something that oscillates infinitely fast, and I can never observe it. So the reason why in the classical limit you never see this non-locality is because the variables, dynamical variables, that have non-local equations of motion, in the classical limit, lose their meaning. They can't be observed anymore. That's very important. Okay. So, when I thought about this, I came to Bohm, and I told him, look, I have something interesting here. What do you think about it? He looked and said, yes, that looks interesting. I don't know what we can do with it, but it looks interesting, okay? So it looked interesting. It looked interesting for quite a while. Both of us thought it interesting. We didn't do anything with it. Just stayed there interesting. Then there was, in the summer in Oxford, there was a summer school. And at that time, this was the most terrible time in physics, where people didn't know how to do renormalization in field theory. So instead, they had discussing field theory and the mathematical discussion of dispersion relation, all kinds of terrible things. This was another example where physics was just a slave of mathematics. Nobody knew what to do, so they just discussed lots and lots of mathematics, of dispersion relation, analyticity. That's how they tried to solve the problem, the real physical problem. So anyhow, David Bohm told me, look, go and see if there is anything interesting in this summer school that we can learn something from it. So I went to this summer school, and one day they discussed the whole thing, the whole business of dispersion, etc., was to discuss not quantum locally, but scattering theory. Heisenberg came with the idea that maybe the only thing that can be observed is the S method, the scattering theory, and then all discussion of physics at this time was all kinds of crazy properties of this S-metric for all kinds of situations. So one day when I was sitting there, they were discussing what will happen when you do a scattering, not by potential, but by a vector potential. So suppose I have in a given region of space a vector potential, how will this scattering look? And then suddenly it occurred to me, maybe we can discuss an analogous thing to this in vector potential, not only regular potential. And I came out with the idea of having a solenoid, and the solenoid is different from zero just, it's perpendicular to the blackboard, it's different from zero just in this region, so I will have a magnetic field. Outside again, I have no magnetic field at all, no electric field, but I have vector potential, because the integral of ADL must be equal to the integral of the kernel of A, which is the magnetic field. So I have here a situation that if a particle will move either here or here and never touch the magnetic field here, it will collect a phase just the same way as it collected before, a phase from the ordinary potential. So I was very excited, came back from this summer school, came back to Bohm and said, look, we can have also a situation like this. And Bohm got excited also, They said, okay, now we can really try to think about publishing it, but before, I want you to solve the following problem. I want you to solve exactly, told me, the problem if I have an infinitesimal of very, very thin solenoid. So I can think about just of a line, a single line of magnetic field, and I want you to solve the problem, the exact problem of scattering from this thing. So I looked at it and I found out that if I look at the plane wave coming here, I can write it as a superposition of angular momentum state. And unfortunately, I had to sum Bessel functions with fractional order. Because it turns out that when we have the vector potential, instead of having Bessel functions of integer order, I have a sum for the plane wave, I have a sum of infinite sum of Bessel function of fractional order. So what do you do when you have to do that? You go and look at the encyclopedia of Bessel functions, Watson or whoever it is, I don't remember. Anyhow, I looked there, couldn't find it. So I was very unhappy about it. Didn't know how to do it.
So just half integer?
What? Just half integer? It's half integer if it's half a flux. For half a factor, it's half integer. It depends on the flux, flux modulo Gamma factor. Half integer is the most interesting one. Now, so for a while I didn't know what to do with it. The chairman of the university there, of Bristol, his name was Price, Eugene Price. And he was a very good physicist and also a good mathematician. He asked me one day, what are you worried about? So I told him about this, and then he came out with the idea that there could be a differential equation that he suggested that if I solve this, it would be a way to do that. Indeed, it worked, and in fact, I was able to do the exact solution of this scattering. Then I came to Price and said that we would like to publish it, we'd like it to be on the three of our names, Aronoff, Bohm, and Price. Said, no, I did not contribute enough, I don't want my name to be on it, you publish it, and that gave me, thank me there. So we published this article, The Significance of the Electromagnetic Potential, and then few weeks later, Price came to me and said, you know, I just came back from Copenhagen, and the only thing they are talking about there is this article, and Bo says that he doesn't believe in it. He couldn't believe that something will be so much against the classical correspondence. Classically, nothing happened. How could there be something that happened differently there? But then, much later, his son convinced him, after reading the article by Ferdinand Ramsey that explained why this effect is necessary for the consistency of quantum mechanics, I will explain to it next time. Then Bo finally was able to accept it. But for a long time, many, many people couldn't accept the idea that things move in the vacuum and still feel something. And therefore, it was considered to be extremely important to do experiments that will verify. The first experiment was actually done at Bristol itself. And the way the history of that experiment is interesting, there was at Bristol, like in probably in many universities in England, the idea that the meeting, the so-called team meeting at 4 o'clock every afternoon, is it still going there? Okay, so this meeting, there was a room where people came and drank tea, and there were some professors and some graduate students. So I was sitting one time in this tea, meeting in the afternoon, and I said, we have this interesting effect, but I'm sure it could never be observed. Why? Because the wavelength of the electron is very, very small. If you take a solenoid of a centimeter or even a millimeter, you can't send the electron around it because the difference of the waves will be so many times wavelength, you could never see a change of a fraction of a wave. And there was a guy sitting there, Sir, something or other, I don't remember his name now, but he was expert in, I will remember his name in a minute, he was expert in solid state. He said, wait, I have an idea. He said, there's something that's called magnetic whisker. magnetic wheels carry something like a very, very thin ferromagnet that grows inside crystals. It's so thin, it's micro, less than micron. He said maybe if you have such magnetic whiskers and you send electrons around it, you will be able to see the effect. And there was an experiment that is by the name of Chambers, which is still alive, I think, right?
Hope so.
You hope so? Yesterday he was alive, right? Okay, it's pretty old, I don't know, it's the 90s, right? But no, anyhow, very nice fellow. So at that time he was sitting in this room and said, okay, I'm going to leave everything I'm doing, I'm going to do this experiment.
And how long was after your theory?
What?
How long was after your theory?
After what?
After your AB.
What was the time lapse between your theory and this experiment?
Oh, it started immediately. Even before we published the article, he heard about it. He said, I'm going to start the experiment immediately. So, he left everything. He had an electron microscope. He took a crystal that had a magnetic whiskers in it and started to do the experiment. I, of course, was very, very excited about it. So I would come every morning to see how the experiment is developing, giving them all kinds of ideas to do it better. And then Chambers called me aside and said, look, if you want this experiment ever to be finished, why don't you go to your room and do your theoretical studies as much as you like, and then we will be able to finish the experiment. So I listened to it, and they were able to finish the experiment. But when they published it, there were still criticism, because if you look at this whisker, this is the whisker of magnetic field, it's not of equal width. And if it's not of equal width, there would be magnetic field that leaked outside. So people did not consider this as a true good experiment. Then, a few years later, there were two German groups that competed in building out solenoids. It was extremely very narrow solenoid. Imagine building a solenoid only Germans can do it. Building a solenoid that with wires that are less, more thin than a micron, and building, and they were able to do the experiment with such solenoids. Okay, I think it was two competing groups, and both of them were able to do it, but still not perfect because the solenoid that has a finite length still has some leakage out. And only Tonomura, the late Tonomura, the Japanese physicist, was able to do a perfect experiment to make sure that this is working. And the experiment that he did was the following. He took a hole of superconductor like a tire, but inside there is a hole. And inside superconductor, you can get a flux that is trapped. And because the superconductor charges are 2E, the flux that is trapped can be either integer or half integer with respect to the electron, and then you can do an experiment by sending electron beam inside and outside and see that there is an effect due to the flux that is fully trapped there, no leakage at all. So that was the final experiment that really verified. Now, I'm telling you all of this because, as I will show you tomorrow, if we look really carefully at what happens when the electron moves around the solenoid, how can we explain dynamically what happens? Is there some interaction between them? Is there some, usually we say in a collision, when two things collide, they exchange momentum. So what happens here when the electron passes by the solenoid? Does it exchange with it something? Beautifully, yes, but it exchanges its modular momentum. I will show you exactly when it happened, and how to observe it. And that the whole thing started. The first time I thought about modular momentum was when I thought about the problem of electrons interacting first with a grating of solenoid. Okay, all of this will be described tomorrow. I promise you that after we do this description, you will have more feeling what it means to have non-local dynamical equations of motion. Okay? Any questions?
So yes? I have a historical question. Do you think it would have been possible for us to develop special theory of relativity out of quantum mechanics?
No, I don't think there is a connection between the two. Take quantum mechanics completely consistent with being completely, you know, basically in the absolute time, I don't think that you will see there any hint. You may see some hint when you consider quantizing electromagnetic field, well, from the beginning the electromagnetic field equations have the lowest symmetry, maybe you would be able to see that, but not when you consider the particles interacting with each other non-locally. Okay? Thank you.
Guys, Lucian asked me to pay attention to the announcement on the board. So tomorrow there are 3 talks at 10 a.m. There are 2 more talks today. And further information is on the digital boards as well.
Yeah. Thank you.